From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Sebastian Younger about his travels through Afghanistan and his meeting with Ahmed Shah Massoud, the long-term leader of the Northern Alliance, the Afghan rebel group fighting against the Taliban. Massoud was assassinated by suicide bombers earlier this month. Younger writes about Massoud in his new collection of essays, Fire. Younger is best known as the author of the bestseller, The Perfect Storm. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the new season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House says President Bush has made no decisions on how to improve aviation security. Spokesman Ari Fleischer said the president discussed some proposed changes today with Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. Fleischer told reporters after the meeting that the issue of reopening Washington's Reagan National Airport had also been discussed. Still no decision on that either. In a rare move today, the Secretaries of State and Defense gave all members of Congress a secret briefing on U.S. military and diplomatic plans to stop terrorism. Administration officials, however, are not sharing much information on troop deployments and missions to reporters. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he'll never lie to the public about military operations, but he'll do just about anything short of that to control the flow of information if it would protect the lives of troops. There are more skillful ways, he says, to handle the problems than outright lying. A heightened secrecy policy at the Pentagon has prompted some members of the news media to wonder if there were plans afoot to give out false information in an effort to trick terrorist targets. One thing Secretary Rumsfeld is direct about is that U.S. military actions will be messy and costly.
It will not be an antiseptic war, I regret to say. It will be difficult, it will be dangerous, and the likelihood is that more people may be lost.
David Maupas, NPR News, Washington.
The airline industry continues to suffer 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks, but the head of the Chicago-based Boeing Corporation says he expects his company to remain profitable. Tony Sarabia of Chicago Public Radio has the story.
Boeing CEO Phil Condit says the company today has revenues of about $1 billion a week. Still, the commercial aircraft part of the business is hurting because of the terrorist attacks. Condit says delivery orders for this year could drop about 7%. 30,000 Boeing employees have been laid off due to the decline in plane orders. Condit says those workers, though, could eventually be called back once the industry rebounds.
We expect that we will be down in production in 02 and 03, hopefully beginning then to come back. So it will be an extended period.
Meantime, Boeing plans to work with the Department of Transportation to develop better security on planes. For NPR News, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
Delta Airlines plans to announce job cuts and a reduction in its winter flight schedule tomorrow. A spokeswoman for the Atlanta-based carrier, which has 82,000 employees, says it plans voluntary leaves, early retirement incentives, and furloughs. Other U.S. airlines have announced about 80,000 job cuts since the terrorist attacks. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 56 points, closing at 86.60. Volume was about 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index was up 2. The S&P 500 closed up 8 points. You're listening to NPR News. The Senate today narrowly endorsed a new round of military base closings. The Bush administration is behind the bill in an effort to redirect spending to the fight against terrorism. The vote was 53-47, with Democrats giving greater support to the president's initiative than he got from fellow Republicans. Opponents of more base closings include Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott of Mississippi, who said it's the wrong time to shut down military bases. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the constitutionality of a school voucher program in Ohio. That could be a key to whether dozens of other states and cities move ahead with the idea. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
When low-income parents use government vouchers to send their children to religious schools, does that violate the principle of the separation of church and state? U.S. Supreme Court justices will be looking at that as they consider Cleveland's experiment with vouchers. They're worth up to about $2,200. Teacher unions and the PTA note that almost all the schools receiving the voucher money are Catholic, Islamic, or fundamentalist. But voucher supporters stress Ohio legislators are considering boosting the worth of the vouchers. They say that will encourage a deluge of private non-religious schools to participate, and then they say the program will be well-balanced. Elsewhere, only Wisconsin and Florida offer vouchers, but if the High Court gives its blessing to Cleveland's program, that could encourage many cities and states to copy it. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
High-level truce talks between Israel and Palestinians have been set for tomorrow. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat and Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres are scheduled to meet tomorrow morning at Gaza Airport. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, supporting the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations to help save the lives of children. GatesFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sebastian Younger, is best known as the author of the bestseller, The Perfect Storm, a nonfiction book about commercial fishermen caught in a deadly storm. It was recently adapted into a film. Younger's new book, Fire, is a collection of his reports about, as he puts it, people confronting situations that could easily destroy them, such as forest fires and war. One of those essays is about Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, the rebel group that has been fighting the Taliban. Massoud was assassinated earlier this month by suicide bombers posing as journalists. Last November, Sebastian Younger traveled with Massoud and the rebels in northern Afghanistan on assignment for a National Geographic magazine article and TV documentary. Many people have worried that the Northern Alliance would be decimated without its legendary leader, Massoud. I asked Sebastian Younger what he's hearing about what's left of the rebel group.
The last word that I've had from my contacts in the Northern Alliance, they seem to be doing okay. I mean, they've lost a very capable and charismatic leader. But someone has stepped in to take his place, someone who, I think Massoud probably realized there was a risk of his assassination. There have been many attempts against his life. And I think he made sure that there was someone designated to succeed him. His name is Mohammed Fahil. He has been with Massoud since 1973. He has fought alongside him all throughout this terrible past 22 years in Afghan history. I met him when I was in there. I didn't have any particular reason to talk with him, so I didn't get much of a sense of him. But I've been assured that he's a very, very capable commander.
What do you know about Massoud's assassins?
I know probably what most of the rest of the world knows, that they're from a North African origin, traveling on Belgian passports, and they said that they were working for a Saudi television network. And I actually spoke with someone who met them, who was waiting in Khojabauddin, where Massoud was killed. He was waiting for Massoud to appear along with these guys, and then this man that I talked to had to leave. But he said that they kept to themselves a lot. They didn't act like journalists. They didn't talk to people. They weren't curious. They kept to themselves, and they waited. It was obviously meant to be a suicide bombing. They had as far as I know, they had no plans for escape. They had packed their television camera with explosives. It's ironic that one of Massoud's most powerful weapons against the Taliban was his own tremendous charisma, both in person and in front of a camera. There's a terrible irony in the fact that that ultimately became the instrument of his destruction.
It's also interesting, too, because the head of the Taliban is supposed to never appear publicly, or at least rarely appear publicly. So it's the opposite of looking good on camera. It's not being near a camera.
Yes, the Mullah Omar has never been photographed, at least not that the West knows about. Frankly, I've never been in the Taliban territory. I've spoken with prisoners of war who were fighting for the Taliban on Massoud's side, but I've never been in the Taliban territory, and I really am not sure why Mullah Omar is so secretive.
You say you considered Massoud a genius guerrilla fighter. Why was he considered such a genius?
Well, the Afghans in general fought off one of the largest military powers in the world. It took them 10 years, the Soviet Union. invaded it in late 1979, and 10 years later they left having lost 15,000 men. And his, Massoud's tactics in particular were very effective. He was defending the Panjshir Valley, a mountain stronghold just north of Kabul, sort of at the crossroads of Afghanistan. And the Russians realized that without controlling the Panjshir Valley, they would never fully control Afghanistan. And they tried, I believe, 11 times to invade the Panjshir Valley with forces of tens of thousands of men, tanks, artillery, air support. Massoud had 3,000 men, and of course none of the armaments. And he repelled their attacks every single time. What he would do is allow them into the valley, classic guerrilla tactics. You don't stand and fight. He would allow them all the way into the valley. They could take anything they wanted. He would withdraw the population so that the civilians didn't suffer. And then he would slowly start attacking the smallest outposts and then the next smallest. And ultimately, he's a genius because, in my mind, because his tactics worked. I feel that's a good definition of genius. And he was widely admired and emulated by other commanders.
Wait, so he'd withdraw from the Panjshir and then do what to attack the Soviets?
He would withdraw up into the mountains where it was too dangerous for the Russian soldiers to go. And often at night, he would come down and start attacking the small outposts. These guys, the Russians, did not want to be fighting. They did not want to be there. They were very easy. It was very easy to scare them, to spook them. Massoud, for example, before attacking an outpost, would mine the road on either side of it so that reinforcements could not come. If he attacked a convoy, a Russian military convoy, he would take out the first and last vehicles so that the convoy was stuck. And instead of trying to wipe the whole convoy out, he would attack them for a while and then pull back. He didn't want to lose men. He didn't want to lose ammunition. And he just kept, basically just kept harassing them. He would buy information. He used every tactic imaginable. He would buy information from Soviet soldiers. He had great, great intelligence contacts in Kabul. Apparently, there were Russian generals who were selling him information about Russian military operations. He used every conceivable tool to fight them. At one point, just as an example, his men had downed a Russian helicopter, and some ingenious mechanic in the Panjshir Valley turned the body of the helicopter into a bus. They put a diesel engine in it and some wheels and were riding this thing around the Panjshir Valley using it as a bus, which of course was tremendously humiliating to the Russians, and they got word of this. And the next time they invaded the Panjshir Valley, Massoud left the helicopter in plain view. So of course the top Russian brass wanted to see this thing, and they all crowded inside to inspect this example of Afghan ingenuity, and he packed it with explosives, and he killed any number of Russian officers in that incident.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sebastian Younger. You probably know him as the author of The Perfect Storm. In his new book, Fire, one of the essays is about meeting and traveling with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the head of the resistance in Afghanistan and was assassinated earlier this month. Massoud first fought against the Soviets in the 80s after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. But then Massoud ended up fighting the Taliban in the 90s. Were his warfare techniques different against the Taliban, who were familiar with that kind of terrain, than the Soviets, who weren't?
Yes, I think his techniques, his strategies did change and may have been forced to change. The Taliban were formed under Pakistan's direction, and are still directed by them and materially aided by Pakistan. And so you had a conventional army, generals in a conventional army who were dictating the terms of war. The war was not a hit-and-run guerrilla warfare against the Taliban. It ended up being real, almost World War I, frontline, entrenched positions, that sort of fighting, tremendous artillery bombardments. The attacks, when they came, were sometimes across open grounds, masses of men rising up and charging the other side. And Massoud found himself locked into a real frontline, conventional war situation. That was exactly the kind of fighting that I saw late last fall. What Massoud said was that had worked to hold off the Taliban. But in order to really start to chip away at their defenses, he was going to now, while holding the front line that stretched from the Tajik border up to Kabul, he was going to initiate guerrilla actions way in the rear of their territory, of the Taliban territory. And we've seen that in the past few months. A commander named Ismail Khan has taken a large swath of territory in the far western part of Afghanistan, hundreds of miles away from the front line where the Northern Alliance supposedly is positioned. They have little spots of territory. Northern Alliance has little spots of territory all over remote areas of Afghanistan. And it has gone back to classic guerrilla war. And that was Massoud's next phase for his grand strategy that may have taken years and years to topple the Taliban.
My guest is Sebastian Younger. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sebastian Younger. His new book, Fire, includes his essay about traveling with Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Afghan resistance group fighting the Taliban. Massoud was assassinated earlier this month. Did you talk to Massoud about why he opposed the Taliban? Because really, the people in the Taliban and the people of the Mujahideen were on the same side against the Soviets, although the Taliban were children in the war with the Soviets. They would have been too young to fight. A lot of the Taliban were the grown up version of the child refugees of the war with the Soviets.
Yes, Massoud told me this, but many other Afghans who I spoke with in the Northeast, in the territory of the Northern Alliance, also told me this. That they were fighting the Taliban because they considered it a foreign invasion. They considered it an invasion by Pakistan. The Taliban troops, they felt, were being not just manipulated but guided and materially supported by the Pakistani army. And while I was there, a Taliban fighter pilot defected to Massoud's side. And the reason that he gave, he landed in the Northern Alliance territory, and the reason he gave was that he realized he was fighting for Pakistan, for a foreign invader, and he was an Afghan, and he wasn't going to do this anymore. I think there are many layers and subtleties for the reasons that Massoud and other Afghans were fighting the Taliban, but that seemed to be the strongest one. There also was, I should say, a very widespread belief that society in the Taliban areas was not a free society. It was not a benevolent society. It didn't have anything to do with Islam. The suppression of women's rights, the suppression of education, of entertainment, the suppression of joy, almost, that really had nothing to do with Afghanistan or with Islam, and it really broke their hearts that was how Afghanistan was now becoming characterized by those strictures. And they wanted to retake not only Afghanistan territorially, but they wanted to take over the spirit of it and the heart of it and reinstitute a fair and free society, which in fact was what I saw in the Northern Alliance territories. I saw women working. Some women had veils because it's a very traditional Islamic culture. But some women didn't. It really seemed to be the choice of the woman, or at least her family. It certainly was not enforced by the authorities, by the government. People played music. They played chess. It was a very, very poor place, and as I said, quite traditional. But there was a sort of a lightheartedness to the society and a freedom that I really liked, and I think would have been completely missing on the other side.
Well, let's get back to Pakistan. You said that Massoud saw the Taliban as almost a foreign invasion, more of a Pakistani force than an Afghani force. What was the connection between the Taliban and Pakistan?
Well, I think it's been quite well established that the Taliban in the early 90s came out of the Afghan refugee camps along the Afghan-Pakistan border. And there's quite a lot of evidence that the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, really had quite a lot to do with recruiting those young men and giving them a very religious education in the madrasas, the religious schools in Pakistan. Of course, that education had a heavily military agenda. And by 1994, they were a force to be reckoned with in Afghanistan. The ISI, the Pakistani government, continued to direct them. And ultimately, when they were locked in battle with Massoud, they would overhear radio communications between Pakistani soldiers. I interviewed a Pakistani soldier who'd been taken prisoner of war by Massoud's forces. They could hear Pakistani generals who apparently were on leave from their own positions in Pakistan. They would go north to help the Taliban in their strategies against Massoud. And there's even evidence, I mean, I haven't seen this. I have to take Massoud's, I had to take Massoud at his word. They even had intelligence that there were Pakistani armored divisions and regular Pakistani soldiers fighting alongside the Taliban. Certainly, I can say from my own experience, I interviewed in a prisoner of war camp about 20 foreign volunteers, many of them Pakistani. They were also from Burma, from North Africa, from Saudi Arabia. They said, "We are here to establish a fundamentalist Islamic state in Afghanistan and to use that as a base from which to export fundamentalist Islam throughout Central Asia, and Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all of those countries, Kyrgyzstan, all of those countries have Islamic insurgencies within their borders." These men were very, very frank about it, and they said Massoud is the last wall, it was the word they used, the last wall that stands between us and what we are trying to accomplish.
Why would Pakistan want to train extremist Muslims to take over Afghanistan? What's in it for Pakistan? Or what was in it for Pakistan?
Well, the geopolitics of that area are incredibly complicated. On a very simple level, I think they wanted to control Afghanistan because, in part, this is what I heard, it provided them with a rear base in their conflict with India. The sort of religious extremism that characterizes the Taliban is, of course, a very easy force to harness if you want to throw young men against, say, the Indian army in Kashmir, or, for that matter, against Massoud. Massoud, during the Soviet times, what they call the Soviet times, the war against the Soviets in the 80s, was a very, very independent thinker. He apparently even got a bit of a bad reputation with the CIA for not following directions from foreign powers, from the CIA. Well, he didn't follow directions from Pakistan either. He really made his own decisions at one point. He made a local peace treaty with the Russians for the Panjshir Valley. The CIA considered that a tremendous betrayal. You know, basically, you were either with the communists or you were killing them. And here was Massoud cutting a temporary local peace deal. What it enabled him to do was to forget about the Panjshir Valley, which was so important, and taking up all of his time, and travel throughout the rest of Afghanistan organizing the kind of resistance that he had organized in the Panjshir Valley. It was a brilliant move. And I think that quality of Massoud's really spooked the foreign powers involved in Afghanistan. I think it continues to. I think for Pakistan, they are almost irrationally upset by the idea of Massoud controlling Afghanistan, even though he had apparently had very little political ambition. The impression I had of Massoud as a man is of someone who is just exhausted by over 20 years of war, living in very, very difficult conditions. And I really had the feeling that he may not even have started his life in this way, but that he had maybe even grown into the realization that peace was the most important thing. He seemed a man just absolutely desperate for peace, and I asked him, what do you want to do after the fighting's over? He said, I want to retire to the Panjshir Valley and read my books, and that's just about it.
It seems Pakistan's in a really funny spot now. If Pakistan helped to create the Taliban, and now we're insisting that Pakistan join our alliance, and they have, at least to some extent, that's a really paradoxical position to be in.
Yes, Pakistan is in an excruciating position. They really, on the one hand, they really do have, morally, they have to help the West in the fight against terrorism. On the other hand, they did play a very strong role in creating the Taliban. And there are many, many supporters of the Taliban in Pakistan. Then there is a very, very strong fundamentalist Muslim ideology in Pakistan. The president of Pakistan, Musharraf, is not in a completely strong and stable position. And he fears, I think many people in the State Department fear, that it wouldn't take much to cause an overthrow of the Musharraf government. And in its place, there would be an extremely reactionary Islamic leadership, which ultimately might create a more dangerous country than Afghanistan is right now. You could almost say it would be Afghanistan with nuclear weapons. Further complicating the problem is there's about a third of Pakistan, which is not even directly controlled by the Pakistani government. It's called the tribal territories. It is filled with ethnic Pashtuns. Pashtuns make up the majority of the Taliban population. And it is a very, very wild and ungovernable place. It's the kind of place where if you were not hiding in Afghanistan, you might choose to hide along the Afghan border. But inside Pakistan, among the Pashtun people who have a tremendous solidarity, a sort of tribal solidarity with each other, it's a very tricky force to tangle with and to try to manipulate.
Sebastian Younger, his new collection of essays is called Fire. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises. Starting next week on Friday nights at 9. Local times may vary. From Book Magazine, for the passionate reader. Featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines. In bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House. Publisher of She Still Haunts Me, a novel by Katie Royfe about Lewis Carroll and Alice, his muse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Sebastian Younger about Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Afghan rebel group fighting the Taliban. Massoud was assassinated earlier this month. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the new season. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Sebastian Younger. He's the author of The Perfect Storm. His new book, Fire, is a collection of his articles about people confronting situations that could easily destroy them, such as forest fires and war. One of the articles is about Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Afghan resistance group fighting the Taliban. Massoud was assassinated earlier this month. Younger went to Afghanistan last fall to talk with Massoud and observe him in action. Did you watch him directly in battle?
Well, he didn't have a gun in his hand charging the enemy, but yes, I did. He was directing the attacks from command bunkers on hilltops. The attacks would start with tremendous barrages of Katyusha rockets and tank fire and artillery fire, and then the men would attack on the ground, generally at night. They were attacking a very strong entrenched position on a ridgeline that ran for miles and miles. And I was just amazed. I mean, we were just watching this sort of light show that was about a couple of miles away. And you could see this through the flashes of light. You could see this attack going on. These men just went straight up this hill through minefields into machine gun fire and topped out on the ridge and took these trenches. It was just tremendous, tremendous bravery. Fortunately, the Taliban, the mood among the Taliban even then was quite demoralized. And one of the reasons that Massoud's casualties were relatively light was that the Taliban really would just run away. At times, they would just run away. The guys who didn't run away were the foreign volunteers, the Saudis, bin Laden's men. Those were the really hardcore fighters. And when the Taliban really needed to hold a line, they didn't use local Afghan conscripts who were given a gun and stuck in a trench and maybe didn't even support the Taliban. They relied on the foreign volunteers, and those guys were scary. Massoud's men really had their hands full in dealing with those guys.
Do you think that Massoud actually expected to win in his fight against the Taliban, or do you think it was just that he refused to give up, even though he didn't expect to win?
I think that his long-term strategy was to remain in place long enough for what is frankly a very unstable regime to start cracking from within, or long enough for Pakistan to realize that they could not continue politically, financially, militarily, could not continue pouring the resources into the Taliban movement, into Afghanistan, that they had been pouring for years. If the Pakistani support dried up, either from foreign pressure or just simply lack of will, that the Taliban on their own really would not have presented much of a problem to him. There were also armed insurrections within the Taliban territory, local villages where they did not want their young men being sent to the front line to fight other Muslims. They just didn't want to do it. And the Taliban would have to put down these rebellions with contingents of armed soldiers. 300-400 soldiers would have to go to these areas and put down the rebellion. That was already happening within Taliban territory. You have to understand that when the Taliban initially came in, Afghanistan was just a lawless hell. I mean, I was there. The warlords controlled different pieces of the highway. There was internal fighting. There would be villages fighting other villages. Tremendous corruption and crime and violence. And people were sick of it. They had been through this for 15 years with the Soviets, and now this. They were doing it to each other. And the Taliban came in, and okay, they had a rather extreme vision of Islam, but they promised to basically clean up the town. They promised to bring peace and order to Afghanistan, and they made good on their promise. But they almost brought too much order. The punishments for crimes were extremely severe. You get your hand chopped off, you'd be executed. Adulterers were stoned and stoned to death. And the population, after a few years of relief, oh, thank God, stability has come. I think they started to bridle under the new Taliban strictures. They didn't realize that that actually was what they had coming to them with the Taliban leadership. Complicating it further was there's been five years of drought in Afghanistan. So the Taliban, not through no fault of their own, did not bring prosperity. The time, forget the war, just in terms of the drought, times are very, very hard there. There's a tremendous amount of hunger. And that, of course, doesn't help the mood of the population either.
You must be wondering, as I am talking to you, if the United States is covertly sponsoring the Northern Alliance, which Massoud led until a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, I think a lot of people are wondering that. But what the Northern Alliance, as my contacts in the Northern Alliance, people who are very, very close to Massoud, have said to me about it. I've been in contact with them a lot in the past 2 weeks. They said that they do not, it is not their wish that more Americans die, that enough precious American lives have been lost in this tragedy in New York and in Washington. And they do not, it is not their wish that Americans come to Afghanistan to die like the Russians did. What they want is help. They want military aid. Basically, what they are offering is, we know the territory, we know how to fight like this, we know our enemy, we will do the fighting, and if need be, we will do the dying for you. Just support us. Isolate Pakistan and the Taliban militarily, economically, politically, and help us on the ground, and we will do it for you. I'm sure that the U.S. government is considering that as an option.
Sebastian Younger, where were you on September 11th?
I was in Moldova. I was on an assignment on trafficking in women in the Balkans, a very, very sad story in its own right. And I was in a small city called Cahul in the south of Moldova. I got a call. My translator got a call on her cell phone that something terrible had happened in the U.S., and we didn't quite believe it. And we rushed back to Chisinau. And on the way back, my translator called her mother, who does not speak English but had access to a television. And she said to her mother, please turn on CNN and just tell me what you're looking at. And her mother did that and just started sobbing, and we knew it was true.
You live in New York. In fact, you own a bar in Manhattan. What was your reaction when you found out what had happened?
My reaction wasn't so much as a New Yorker. It was more as an American and, frankly, as a citizen of the world. It felt like, my God, this is a possible scenario for another global war. I was really scared for us all. People in Moldova would come up to me very, very sweetly and say, I'm so sorry what happened in your country. And I wanted to say to them, you know, we're now talking about all of us. There no longer is the welfare of one particular country or another particular country. We now see that it's all interrelated. And we, the world, are in tremendous danger right now. And we have to handle, we, the United States and the entire world, has got to handle this crisis correctly. We cannot do something that further fractures relations between the West and the Islamic world. I fear that that may be exactly what bin Laden is trying to do, and we have to take great care not to do that.
What do you think would be playing into his plans?
This is purely conjecture from a man who reads the newspaper every day, but I think that one strategy might be to provoke a massive military response by the U.S. and polarize the world between the West and the Muslim world, to galvanize support even among Muslims who condemn the World Trade Center bombing. But of course, they don't want their fellow Muslims to be subject to a military attack. And so there might be maybe the thinking of these terrorists is, if we can provoke a massive attack, we can generate a unity among Muslims that overrides their own particular horror at what was done in New York. That would be a terrible tragedy for everybody. And I hope that the people in our government are thinking about that. I'm very heartened by the fact that our country is taking its time in preparing a response. I think that's that's really a wonderful sign that we're proceeding very wisely and examining all the possible repercussions politically, socially, in a military action.
My guest is Sebastian Younger. His new book is called Fire. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sebastian Younger. He's the author of the bestseller, The Perfect Storm. His new book, Fire, is a collection of essays and reporting, and one of the pieces is about Ahmed Shah Massoud, who was the leader of the resistance in Afghanistan, but he was assassinated a little less than a couple of weeks ago. I'm wondering about you and your interest in people in extremes. I mean, this last extreme kind of came to you, but you've been in search of it for many years. You know, in writing the book, The Perfect Storm, your new collection, Fire, is, reporting from various war zones, reporting on people who fight huge fires. What attracts you to that state of extreme?
Well, I'll have to go back 10 years. I couldn't make a living as a writer, as a journalist, and I was working as a climber for tree companies and writing a little bit on the side, sort of struggling with it. And I hurt myself quite badly, and it got me thinking, many people in America don't realize that there are jobs that are tremendously dangerous that people are doing every day. They get hurt at them. They get killed on them. And it was a time in the early 90s in America when people were more and more sort of enamored of adventure sports, extreme sports, which of course are very dramatic and very impressive as sort of feats of human endurance or skill, but they don't directly help anyone. The society doesn't need more people to climb mountains, however impressive that is. But they do need people to drill for oil, to fish, to farm, and to fight fires. And I thought, in maybe a somewhat grandiose way, I'm going to write a book on dangerous jobs, and I'm going to tell America how amazing these people are and how important their jobs are. They're running risks that sometimes far outweigh the risks run by people in extreme sports, and they're doing something necessary. They're doing maybe something even noble in doing the work that needs to be done in our nation. And so I picked out forest firefighters and commercial fishermen to start on, and I flew out west and hung out with these hotshot crews in 1992. And then after that, I wrote about commercial fishermen in my book, The Perfect Storm. That was the start of what is now my career. And I find it tragic and ironic that it took the death of so many good people, firemen and policemen at the World Trade Center, to finally bring that recognition. Look, this job is important. Think about these guys. Think what they're doing. They rushed those guys. I don't know what they're paid a year, $30,000 a year or something like that. They were rushing up 110 flights of a skyscraper to help people, some of whom made 10 times that much. And just the class issues alone were really, really, really amazed me, that the desire to save human life on the part of these guys transcends every other issue, including their own safety. I just found that incredibly moving. And I'm so glad that the American public now has sort of become focused on that and is so appreciative. It's a wonderful thing.
Is physical courage something you feel you really understand or have much of yourself?
No and no. I'm not sure what physical courage is. I think ordinary people, and I think I might include myself in that, can do tremendously courageous things in a situation that demands it. And at other times, they're just paralyzed by fear. And I've been in situations where I was really absolutely terrified. One was in Afghanistan during a sort of nasty incident we were caught in, I was amazed at my capacity for fear. I was amazed that it could that the feeling of fear could completely fill me from my toes to the top of my head. I didn't know that. You know, I've been in other situations where I think I acted, that I responded in a more sort of controlled and effective way. So I think it really depends from moment to moment how any person reacts to danger. I think we all have the capacity to face tremendous danger, tremendous fear, if another person is at risk, particularly someone we love. I think that really transcends just about anything. But I've never been in that situation, fortunately.
So what happened in Afghanistan when you were totally filled up with fear?
We went up to the front line to a position that had just been taken from the Taliban. I mean, the Taliban guns were still pointing the wrong way. They hadn't even turned the guns around yet. It was a hilltop position, and it took half the day to walk out there. And just as we got there, the Taliban, who were not that far away, started a rocket attack. And these rockets were just raining down on the position, and we were all curled up in the trenches. And what scared me most was the idea that we wouldn't be able to get out of there. The day was ending. It was starting to get dark. I figured that they would probably keep this up all night. And it's hard to explain how terrifying it is to hear a rocket come at you. And you could hear this whistling sound as it comes in, and then this incredible detonation. It is absolutely terrifying. The idea of going through that all night just seemed too much to bear. And, of course, that would be a prelude to an attack on the ground. And I didn't know if the men I was with could hold that position. And if they couldn't, if we were overrun, almost anything could have happened. And I was just curled up there thinking, you know, I don't want to do this to my family, first of all, to die on this hilltop. This isn't my hilltop, and it's not my country. And I don't belong in this situation right now. I owe it to the people who love me to not be here. I can do my journalism in a somewhat different way. It was a very, very valuable insight to have.
You have spent years traveling to places where people are working in extremes and where people are risking their lives for the work that they do. You come home, and your home, Manhattan, is has been the subject of a terrorist attack. There have been a lot of people who have not only risked their lives but given their lives in the hopes of saving others, and all the things that you've gone for in other people's disasters are now on your doorstep at home.
Yes, that made me very sad. That was one of the really difficult things to think about, was that now none of us have a refuge. One of the things that makes, psychologically speaking, that makes foreign reporting in war zones possible, at least for me, is that you, even if you don't exercise this option, you know that you can leave and you can go home to a refuge, the United States, this wonderful country with all its liberties and its safety and its freedom. That's what's waiting for you at home, and you could spend a year in Rwanda, you know, or some terrible, terrible situation, and you know that you can go back. And now I realize that there is no place to go back to, and that's terrible for me, and it's terrible for everyone. And it's going to take a long time, I think, for me to fully digest the implications of that.
Well, Sebastian Younger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sebastian Younger's new collection of essays is called Fire. It includes his piece about Ahmed Shah Massoud. Younger's documentary on Massoud will be shown tonight on the National Geographic Channel. Younger is also the author of The Perfect Storm. The postponed new TV season has begun. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli tunes in. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The fall TV season began yesterday, belatedly, and TV critic David Bianculli is starting to refocus on the new and returning shows somewhat reluctantly.
I'm still not sure I'm ready for this. Does it really matter what the best new show of the fall season is? Or the worst? Do people care anymore how Buffy comes back to life on Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Or whether Rachel is pregnant on Friends? And do I care? Here's what I do know. When I previewed all 10 hours of the HBO World War II miniseries Band of Brothers, before the attack on New York and Washington, I remember one feeling very distinctly. The battle scenes in that drama were so intense and so unrelenting and frightening that I began to cherish the moments when things were quiet. I became grateful for the peace. I became hungry for normal. That's the way I feel today, 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks. When I look up at my wall of TV sets right now, I don't see Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw. I see Everybody Loves Raymond and Monday Night Football and Frasier. What this means to me, and I suspect to you, is that things are better than they could be. Someday soon, I'm afraid, we're going back to wall-to-wall news, and not for the last time. But in between, primetime TV will serve up some moments of peace. So I guess, just as I welcomed the quiet and Band of Brothers, I should welcome the new and returning fall shows. I suspect as a country we're going to gravitate more immediately and emotionally to returning familiar shows than to new ones. Checking in on Frasier or Friends or Once and Again, all of which return with season premieres this week, will be a good thing. So the worthwhile shows that are coming back this week, in case you want to find them, include the following. Spin City and Frasier tonight. Drew Carey and Law and Order tomorrow. CSI Crime Scene Investigation and the entire NBC lineup on Thursday. That's Life and Once and Again on Friday. And Saturday Night Live this weekend, which ought to be really interesting under the circumstances. Also, Buffy the Vampire Slayer returns a week from tonight with a 2-hour season premiere that is every bit as good as I hoped. Also next week, Aaron Sorkin presents a special last-second episode of The West Wing, reacting to the terrorist attacks. So the old shows not only are coming back, some of them are coming back with a vengeance. As for the new ones, I'll keep it simple. Some of the best ones, 24 on Fox, Smallville on the WB, don't show up until the second half of October. The others premiere tonight and tomorrow, Undeclared tonight on Fox, and Enterprise tomorrow night on UPN. Enterprise is the latest entry in the Star Trek franchise, but is fresh instead of stale. It's a prequel, so we're setting out on the maiden voyage of the starship Enterprise 100 years before Captain Kirk. Nothing works, no one gets along, and everything and every alien is new. It's an approach that reinvigorates the entire, well, I was going to say Enterprise, but you get the idea. And it also works because of the new captain, played by Quantum Leap star Scott Bakula. He's just right for this role, and UPN should have a hit on its hands. By UPN standards, anyway. As for tonight's Undeclared, it's the kind of comedy TV doesn't make much of anymore. In other words, it's a funny comedy. It stars Jay Baruchel as Steven, a college freshman sharing a co-ed floor with a half-dozen other youngsters seeking to define and redefine themselves. The humor comes not from punchlines, but from characters. And by the time the first episode is over tonight, you'll know and like every one of them. To me, though, the secret weapon is singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright, who plays Steven's father. On his son's first night at college, he drops in with the surprise news that Steven's mother has asked him for a divorce. They start to have a father-son talk, but it doesn't last long.
What happened? I don't know. She says she's miserable. She doesn't want to have sex. She feels dead inside. Life is passing her by. I don't know.
I don't want to talk about this. Dad, we're in the middle of a party, okay? This is my first day at school.
Steven, I've given my entire life to you. So if I need to talk to you, you're gonna listen.
I'm sorry. So, why do you think Mom feels dead inside?
I don't know.
Has she said why she doesn't want to have sex with you?
You know what? You're right. This is not the time. I don't want to ruin your first night, so I'm going to go crash at Uncle Bill's.
Okay, good stuff.
I just wanted to let you know that's where I'm going to be in case you want to get in touch, all right?
Cool, thanks.
We'll talk about this tomorrow.
Okay? Right, yeah.
All right? So have fun at the party.
Thank you. Have fun, Uncle Bill's.
All right, I will.
Cool.
I laughed at Undeclared a lot, and so did my high school and college-aged kids when we first watched the preview tape before the attacks. I put the tape back in the other day and watched again, and laughed again. These days, I don't think there's any higher praise I can deliver.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Our program is produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shirok, Anne-Maria Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Dorothy Farabee. I'm Cherie Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at SaabUSA.com. From Anchor Books, paperback publishers of Disobedience, the new novel by Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World and The Book of Ruth. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our new poet laureate, Billy Collins. He has a new book of poems. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.